Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey guys, before we start the show, I just wanted to make you guys aware and let you guys know that Edward Ashoff, friend of the pod, friend of Banner Society, a damn good Gator and a really good college football reporter and a really, really, really good person who recently passed away on Christmas Eve. Donations to his memorial fund. The University of Florida set up a memorial fund for him and the Journalism and Communications Department. And if you're, you know, if you're willing to donate or want to donate something in his memory, those checks can be made out to UF Foundation and they can be sent to P.O. Box 14425, Gainesville, Florida, 32604, with an attention for gift processing. And in the memo area of the check, just write Edward Ashoff Memorial Fund. Thanks and enjoy the show.
Podcast ain't played nobody. I'm just going to paint you a picture real fast. My name is Stephen Godfrey at 38 Godfrey on Instagram and Twitter. Podcast ain't played nobody is part of the Banner Society. You can find it on the same social devices and what such. You know my co-hosts, of course. Bud Elliott and Richard Johnson. Before I let them speak, I want to paint you a picture very quickly. We are done with AFCA, gentlemen. We are currently sitting in a hotel room designed for bachelorette parties, exclusively designed for bachelor and bachelorette parties in Nashville, Tennessee.
Definitely bachelorette parties.
Definitely.
I understand we don't want to be too gendered here, but this is... a bachelorette party if it threw up.
Okay. We have not had lunch yet. We're recording this at the end of our Banner Society winter sort of off-season meetings. We are very tired. We have done a lot of talking to football coaches over the week. We are also very hungry. I'm setting the scene just to give you guys sort of a level of quality you should expect.
We're gonna play through the adversity.
And Bud has to get to the airport, and he wants to eat before he does.
Bud,
so this is gonna be a tight 45.
Bud is antsy about not only hunger but also airport transportation. So we have both hungover energy and dad energy going, gentlemen. We were at AFCA for a good 4 days, basically. We saw each other a little bit. We were crisscross paths. We're walking around a giant convention. It's a very strange place in Nashville. I don't describe it too much, waste time on that, but it's big atriums and sections and these weird hotels. It's kind of like an Orlando Disney vibe way out by the airport in Nashville, Tennessee.
If you know Opryland in Nashville, that's what we're talking about.
Strange place. But it's filled with about 6,000-7,000 football coaches. My personal highlight was watching Bud Elliott, and I think Richard, you and I were sort of like staring each other in the face when this happened. But how many times this year did you accuse Toledo of point shaving?
I think twice. Yeah.
Okay.
So we're sitting there at the sports bar there, and I have a Toledo guy who I'm tight with, and I finally get asked him personally. I was like, "All right, other than those couple games, you guys weren't bad. Like, were your kids throwing them? Like, what was the deal there?"
No. Don't undersell the moment. Okay, don't undersell the moment.
What did I say to him?
We were sitting.
You literally were like, were you guys throwing games? Right, or something?
Yeah. There was no polite way of doing that. Because I was like, once I realized we were talking to a Toledo staffer, which is fine, very nice guy, whatever. We were talking about the Mac and all that stuff. I then realized, like, this is the same school that Bud has accused of point shaving on our show multiple times this season. And then I thought, well, Bud won't bring that up. Bud not only brought it up, he asked it like he was a courtroom reporter in the 1930s. Like, it was absolutely my favorite moment.
Now, in fairness, Godfrey walked up later on the conversation. We'd already been talking to him for probably like 5-10 minutes. Yeah. It wasn't like the first question we asked him when he sat down.
Yeah.
Hey, how you doing? D did you guys throw games for money this year?
How the hell were you favored by 24 and lose by 24?
I think this year was different because, so to set the scene, that scene, me and Bud had gotten a table at whatever, you know, sports bar that's inside this big old convention hall. And like, we'd have some guys just like come through, like, hey, sit down, like, right. You know, pick brains for 10, 15 minutes.
So much of your time is wasted, like, trying to DM and text you, hey, where are you going to be in 10 minutes? Where are you gonna be? They're like, hey, I'll be done with this meeting in like 5. Like, I'll meet you here. I'm like, this is a huge damn convention. Like, I can't walk there in 5 minutes. Like,
yeah.
I have to sprint. So instead, Richard and I were like, we're just going to set up shop at this table here in the sports bar. And we'll just be like, hey, we're going to be here for like the next
45 minutes, swing through.
4 hours.
Yeah.
4 hours.
Yeah.
Four hours.
Like, swing through. And like, I think I actually like that strategy. So yeah. Look, for those that don't know, this is the American Football Coaches Association convention. There are 7,000 football coaches at this convention from college and high school, and some like pro personnel guys, but it is mostly college and high school overwhelmingly. The amount of logos that you'll see, I mean, the Oregon O is refashioned in all different type of colors, shapes, and sizes.
It's the new Georgia G.
For these different high school programs, you would have no idea. Yeah. And you know, there's not a lot of FBS head coaches there. There's a head coaching meeting on the last day, and they will come in for that. But for the most part, it is kind of coordinator level and below mostly. Some staffs aren't here. Like, I know Colorado State staff wasn't here because the weekend of AFCA was like the first time they all got together and like actually had a full staff meeting.
By and large, other than obviously LSU and Clemson, there was some representation from most of the schools. As Richard said, you would see occasional FBI. I mean, you'd see Pat Fitzgerald sort of going through the halls like a politician, or maybe like a David Cutcliffe or something like that. But this is where you go and you're like, hey, I know that guy. He was on that staff when I went to visit that school, and it's like running backs coach, and now he's at this school or that kind of thing. And for me specifically, it was always about just expanding network. Hey, what's going on? Would love to talk to you guys. I mean, this goes back for years when SB Nation was launching, before we were Banner Society. Richard, for you, it's an added wrinkle of, you know, there's a lot of politicking going on, a lot of people trying to get jobs. You see a lot of people walking around with resumes, but also it's a lot of talking shop in the strategy sense.
Yeah, this is the closest thing this sport really has to like a true smoky back room. Because like, James Franklin may be here, but James Franklin's not walking through the convention floor because James Franklin's going to get mobbed. What James Franklin's here to do is interview for a wide receivers coach in his suite.
Yeah.
So he will have coaches roll through and they will do the job interviews here at the convention because everybody's here. But yeah, there are a lot of like, I mean, they're seminars. I mean, mm-hmm. I guess you can call them. They're breakout sessions where you can go and hear anything. Like there were analytics breakout sessions. There were I went to one done on like speed and how to do speed training.
And most of your college coaches are not going to these, to be clear. Like it's almost like a running joke that you go learn something at AFCA. The thing is, the high school coaches who are paid by their school districts to go, they have to get the code number so they can put it in for, like, if any of y'all are attorneys or doctors out there, I'm sure you have like continuing legal or continuing medical education.
CLE classes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is like continuing coaching education, CCE. So they get the number, they plug it in, and then you see like maybe a third of the room get up and leave before the thing actually starts.
That's what the like PD whatever number. Yeah, before every like speaker goes, they say like the PD whatever number is such and such and such.
We were next to Bill in the analytics one where we were sitting. He started writing down like, you need to write that down.
Bill C.
But yeah, and so I like. Some of this stuff kind of becomes like very cool. I went to Florida State's new offensive line coach, Alex Atkins, formerly at Charlotte as offensive coordinator. He kind of did kind of like a brown bag session with a bunch of coaches where they just kind of like got together, got a room and got a projector and threw some stuff on the board and sat and kind of talked ball. And I kind of sat in the back and was kind of a fly on the wall for that. And that was really cool. It was really cool to hear him talk very in frank terms about some of the things that they did this season at Charlotte. Because, and Bud, like, you can kind of attest to this, like, the profession is so, like, insular and, like, espionage, except for when it's not. Yeah. And like, this is when it's very much not, and it's just very interesting to kind of like watch it happen.
This is probably the most honest coaches are with you, like, in mass all year, right? Like, they're not in the middle of the season prep. They're not, like, right in the middle of recruiting because we're still in the dead period for another 48 hours. They're really open and honest about stuff, and they'll just say stuff, right? I mean, like, it's interesting to hear them. I mean, I was talking to some guys. I was like, what do you think? He's like, well, one of the coaches was replacing a guy that he respects a lot. He's like, if that's the best that he could do with those guys, because I've watched the tape from last year, then I got to go out and get some transfers, because I know, like, he's an awesome coach. I've clinicked with him before.
Yeah.
And there's no way, like, these dudes can't play.
So the reason why we invest so much in AFCA, and you've heard us talk about it in the offseason periodically and in the in-season about how it's a big moment, is some news breaks, some people get interviewed, but it is that candor and honesty that really defines the event for us, because you build relationships with guys, you talk on and off the record as a reporter, and you hear things. You hear things that are isolated, funny, weird, sad, whatever, in the coaching profession. What's always interesting to me is when you hear the same thing from different parties and different groups, and you start to understand what is the real, like, narrative, storyline, whatever you want to call it, that's emerging in the coaching circles this year. So we got one. It's probably not what anyone would expect. Bud or Richard, who wants to start on this? Because I'm trying to remember who heard it first.
Where are you going?
Tom Herman.
That was probably good. I didn't hear that.
So there's a lot of coaches sitting around talking about the state of things, who's up, who's down. You know, obviously everyone on a much more public forum, people are going to talk about, hey, LSU just lost off a lot of people off the national title team, right? What we're always kind of looking for is that, what's that thing underneath the surface? And that it kept coming back to Texas and Tom Herman, and there's some real anxiety around that program that maybe people wouldn't expect.
Like, the vibe I got was, hey, he just had to replace both coordinators, right?
And guys who were close to him.
Yeah, like, stuff that it was not easy for him to do. Everybody knows what the next step is, right? Like, you don't get to ask both your coordinators twice.
Yeah.
You either win or you get lost. And I don't know that he has the level of support there that maybe just I assumed that he once did.
It's very funny to me, because we were talking about Texas, again, in the big, broad, national level of, hey, it was never supposed to be 2019, right? It was supposed to be 2020, guys, and now they have LSU. They go to Baton Rouge next year. This is more of a decisive year than I think we realize for Texas, because if this doesn't work and we don't see immediate application of the new coordinators, if we don't see the effect on the existing roster immediately, everything's going to ratchet up. Because, oh, by the way, as PAPN has mentioned 100 times, Texas A&M has the world's greatest schedule for, like, 80% of the first 80% of their season.
Is Texas LSU, is that an early game next year, do we know?
It's I want to say, like, week two or three.
I mean, yeah. LSU is losing 14 or 15 starters off this team. Like,
right.
You want to get this team that, like, I'm sure they'd love to play a week zero game against LSU. LSU would probably prefer not to play a week zero.
And we'll have at least one, Steve Ensminger's not a new offensive coordinator, but we'll have one offensive coordinator change and perhaps a defensive coordinator change, given the news. It is Thursday afternoon, 1:45 God's time zone.
God's time zone.
I'm live in God's time zone.
I'm so proud of him.
And Dave Aranda is being linked as a leader for the Baylor job. We'll see if he actually gets it by the time you hear this. But LSU may have two new coordinators. Joe Brady's gone to the Panthers.
Exactly. And I don't want to say, like, it's a foregone conclusion on Herman at all. I mean, I think you can honestly look at this and say this is a major opportunity. They're timing up LSU the right time. Like, Baylor is going to have a new head coach. We know because Rule already left. Oklahoma has a new quarterback. And I think they're going to light the world on fire with Rattler and those second-year receivers. But, I mean, there's a legitimate chance to win 10-11 ball games at Texas this year because of what you bring back.
This is a very make or break, by the way, just so people don't scream directly into their podcast device. It is week two, Saturday, September 12th. One thing that these programs have in common, they will play one tune-up game beforehand. Both will be playing new head coaches. Texas opens with South Florida, and then LSU opens with Texas San Antonio. So they will both get basically the same experience before they play one another in Baton Rouge in week two. No one's saying he's on the hot seat necessarily, but everything's going to come to a very fine point, I think it's fair to say, and that's what people were talking about. Also, there's a lot of jealousy, for lack of a better term, at these events, because you see a lot of career grinders. And when someone goes through a period of being the belle of the ball, so Joe Brady right now is the smartest man in football, right? At this moment, it will be someone else. It always is. There was a time in which Tom Herman was the greatest college football coach in the world, right? When Houston beat Florida State, when he's landing five-star defensive linemen to an AAC school, that, you know, the comeuppance, the come around on that is sharp. And I think that's why we probably heard so much about him and people kind of grousing about it.
There is also the, I mean, this is also a job fair.
Yes.
I mean, there are guys who are here for fundamentally different reasons. Some guys are here to drink, and I am serious. I
saw some coaches I know who had the shakes in the morning.
Dude.
This is during
alcohol problems. I know they have alcohol. Man, like, makes sad because they're not getting help.
This is a recruiting dead period, right, bud? Okay. Recruiting dead period before the final signing day, legacy signing day push starts. So there's a window where they literally, by NCAA rules, cannot be out recruiting on the road.
Right.
So the national title game, like, the convention starts Saturday. Everybody gets in Saturday, and it goes Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. Last year, I think it went Wednesday, but whatever. So by Monday, everybody's biggest stressor by Monday afternoon is where they're going to watch the game at.
Yeah.
I'm serious. You have a conversation, and every conversation ends up, so where are you going to watch the game at? And it's funny that is kind of the state of play. But yeah, so there's that faction. There are the coaches who are very much here to hang out with their boys and party.
Yeah, you can come here with totally secure job. Totally.
Because it's not expensive. It's like $50.
No.
The Gaylord is expensive.
The hotel is expensive, but like the actual convention itself is not expensive.
You get
to register.
All the staffers and stuff who like are not like they're not actual coaches. They're just staffers. And like, I really want to get a ticket.
They're analysts.
Like, I want to get into the Adidas party, or like, I can't believe Under Armour didn't have a party, or like,
right,
a lot of GAs.
The one I went to last year, it's not in existence anymore because the bar tab ran up sky high.
Our bad. So there's a little bit of that.
But were you at that? You were at that party too, right? But
briefly,
yeah, we all contributed to that bar tab.
But there is also guys who are very much here to get a job in a much more desperate sense, in a sense of they do not have the network. They do not have.
Oh, someone's knocking on the door in the middle of the podcast.
Probably housekeeping
at the Bachelorette Party Hotel.
It's probably housekeeping.
This is live. Thank you. Oh, I'm keeping that in the show.
Oh, absolutely.
She was laughing. Look, I'm going to be real. Okay, she just walked in with three dudes standing around a very little table holding microphones. That ain't even the fifth weirdest thing that hotel employee
hotel
has seen
in
a week. Not even a chance.
I think it was a guy.
Oh, I'm sorry. I couldn't hear the voice. Either way.
So there is a little bit of legitimate like job need in a more desperate sense. If I don't have the network, if I can't go with my guys to, you know, whatever head coach or whatever coordinator or whatever, there's three or four or five like cork boards in the middle of the convention floor,
man.
And it's just resumes. I mean, resumes top to bottom, left to right.
So
resumes.
Sad.
I mean, you go in the bathroom. I went in the bathroom and there was a coach who had kind of left his business card fanned out in threes next to every sink. Like, not every coach is here, like, living on the hog. Not every coach is making $150,000 a year.
No, I know.
To coach receivers.
I mean, I've talked to guys before where it's like, yeah, we would come here every year as, like, young. Like, a lot of guys were newlyweds. They were broke. They were on GA salaries, making 10 grand, you know, all those stories. And they'd go eight up to, like, a Motel 6 just so they could be here to shake hands. And, I mean, you know, the odds of suddenly landing a magical job because you shook the right hand on the convention floor are shit, but networking is real. Networking works. And so the levels of hunger, like you're pointing out, are vast at this deal, because you have people who are just here to be like, hey, my best friend was an O-line coach and I was a D-line coach at this school. He got a job on the West Coast. I hadn't seen him in 2 years, so we're going to hook up, have a good time. There's plenty of that. And I go and hang out with those guys, listen to them gossip. And then there's also like the saddest resume hunting in the world in an industry that does not care about you.
The other flip side of that is like I was talking to a buddy of mine who coaches at a very high-level Power 5 school. And he didn't have his logo polo on. And I was like, yo, are you good? Like, did you get fired or something? Right. And he was like, nah, man, I can't walk through this thing without getting pulled left, right, and center by every coach. I mean, like, I use the James Franklin example because I saw James at one point, and there were, like, three or four, like, autograph seekers that had those white, like, mini Penn State helmets that were, like, waiting to get James to get his autograph.
The guy had a suitcase up.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah. Oh, so he's hitting that eBay action. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. A couple news items I just wanted to roll through that happened while we were on the convention floor doing this. I'm going to start with Wazoo because it was funny. Like, Nick Rolovich has been on PA Panem before. We talked to him when he was the Hawaii head coach leading into this season. He's now the head coach at Washington State. A couple things real fast. Well-executed search. I thought interesting pool of candidates. Not a ton of diversity in terms of race or ideas, but for Wazoo, I think from what I've heard, they made it clear they were going to spend some money early on. I think that changed the tenor of the search, and people did not treat Wazoo quite like I think people thought they would in terms of this also ran lower tier Pac-12 job. So congrats to Rolo. He was going to be here at the convention, and if you wanted to go like hang out or have an adult beverage with a sitting FBS head coach, he's probably what top three that you would pick.
He's up there.
I DM'd him. I said, hey, are you coming to convention this year? It's in Nashville. And his way of saying, yes, I'm coming to convention before the Wazoo stuff happened was to send me a GIF of the Ultimate Warrior running to the ring.
As one does.
So Wazoo executes a very nice search. Pretty tight, pretty concise. A lot of people talking about Baylor. A lot of people talking about Billy Napier and sort of the inertia there. What did you guys hear? What was the weirdest thing that you heard in relative to like news breaking in real time? Was there anything extremely strange?
I won't say news breaking real time, but we'll get to the Pac-12 in a broader sense.
I don't want to make Bud feel that good throughout the whole show.
Right. We'll get to the Pac-12 in a broad sense in a second. But when there's a lot of the times you'll bounce stuff off guys in a sense of, oh, what do you think about X, Y, or Z? And they will too.
Yeah.
And when you brought up, what do you think about Clay Helton still being the USC coach?
Oh, shit.
Everybody, I'll tell you this. Everybody west of Texas is thrilled that Clay Helton is still USC's head coach, which should tell you something about USC.
Also,
should tell USC something.
Some recruiting-minded assistant and head coaches east of the Mississippi who are still happy about it because now, as Bud said on the show before, it's open season in Los Angeles. I don't know if there was ever a wall, but if there was a fence and it was chain length, it's been run over. I mean, you can go into LA now with a lot of confidence and recruit out.
We also had multiple people speculate to us. They think USC is broke, or especially broke compared to what you think USC has money-wise. And we can't tell because USC is private and we don't have their books. But that was their reasoning. It was like, there is no way in hell that they believe Clay Helton can get the job done. The only reason this makes any kind of sense is because they didn't have the money to both fire Helton and give a guy like James Franklin what he would have wanted in terms of facilities, commitment, analyst, staff size, all those, and money, you know, for a buyout type thing there. So I was surprised at how many people were like, yeah, I think USC's broke. They had that huge scandal that they had to
Bring
out an enormous, not from the athletics, but like a huge settlement for. I mean, at some point that stuff adds up, so it's not implausible. It's just surprising.
And as we were at the convention, three staffers in the athletic department tied to, I don't even know what the gate, what is the scandal name that we're calling the Lori Loughlin, Felicity Huffman thing? What's it called?
It's Varsity called like Blues. Varsity Blues.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. So the Varsity Blues scandal, which is different than some of the other scandals at USC, has cost three jobs at the university, and that's just in the last week. So, I think what we're hearing in Bud's kind of larger theories about it is it's just – we don't even know if the dust is necessarily settled yet. So maybe there's a little bit of method to madness on keeping him, even if it's not financial. You know, Bud, you're talking about them being broke. I do think they're fundamentally broken. That came up so much. Was so many people talked about USC in the context of I'm just going to say this because this is the one example that Richard and I got the most, was James Franklin going there. And
Everybody's terrified about that. Yeah, actually,
that was a quote. They were like, we would be scared if Franklin went there because he would go and be the forward facing CEO style media darling, playing Los Angeles, playing all the way through California, treating it like it is. It's the world's cultural capital in terms of entertainment. He would utilize that, seize upon it. Him being a minority, there's a million things that he could do different and signature and unique at USC. I think I heard a couple other names, but Franklin was like the one, Richard, that everyone kept using as the test case. So USC's broken. Everybody's actually really happy about that. All right.
The West Coast is really happy.
People have questions about Tom Herman. I think by and large, people are pretty happy for Rollo. I mean, that was one where, like, yeah, there are some coaching hires I won't get into necessarily where, like, you know, Coach X gets the job, and a lot of people are like, man, fuck that guy. So it is nice to point out when, like, even way, way off the record, a lot of coaches are like, hey, yeah, good guy, way to go. A lot of people had very different theories about what to do with Baylor.
Yeah, I don't know if... So I will say the one thing that when you hear – you, listener, dear listener, hears Baylor, the antenna perks up because of what happened at Baylor.
Right.
I understand that. That's not what coaches think, and it's not necessarily because they either do or don't care about those issues. What I mean when I say that is in coaching years, 5 years or 4 years since Art Briles got fired and is gone, like – That's dog years to them. So they are talking about and considering the program in a different light just from a time perspective.
Yeah.
And that's one of the most interesting things that I think you get when you talk to people who are coaches who are on the inside of the profession, how they consider how time passes and how that changes a job for better or for worse.
And the coaches know what they pay rule.
They know
how committed they are to winning, that they can get kids into school academically in the state of Texas. Like, everything is there to win. Not like national championship win, but to win. I mean, Rule had pretty quick success there, and I think quicker success than I thought he would have, certainly. And, like, that scene is a very good job, especially because they're willing to pay top dollar.
So that right there, I think, does not get enough attention when, like, we all individually go do talk radio, or you're just talking with friends who like college football, or you're talking, I mean, even inside of our PAPN community with our fans. A lot of people are going to say Mississippi State has a job opening. Well, damn, that's a really tough job. So they're only going to be able to get X level of candidates.
You're going to get $20 million guaranteed.
That's... The money is dictating the pool, yeah, not the toughness of the job. And don't let some coach say, man, I like a challenge. I'm not talking about that. The bottom line is what a coach is doing is going, man, I like $12 million guaranteed, and I'll go be a damn DC after this. That's what they're thinking about. They're thinking about the concept of how much can I get locked in guaranteed on a contract that, as Bud says all the time, like, not a lot of those coaches on those lower tier SEC West schools get that second deal.
I am glad you brought up Mississippi State. Did anybody have a conversation with anyone who thought it was going to work with Leach at Mississippi State?
Honestly, no.
Yeah, I did.
You did?
But it was only from the standpoint of, like, do you think that they expect the results Mullen had there? Because if they're realistic, it could work. I don't think they're realistic.
I think any program in the P5 that has a certain level of success, you know, once that needle's moved to a particular new height, it's pretty hard to adjust back down. We don't see that a whole lot. The talking points I got was they're good for one really explosive year where Leach can get the right streak with the right personnel. And he's done this in the Big 12 and he's done this in the Pac-12 where he not only runs a streak of, let's say, like upsetting an LSU, he'll then turn around and beat an Auburn as well in the same season, have a 9 or 10 win year, go to like a Cotton or something like that. Is that sustainable? No one I talked to believed that. And then what most people I spoke to mentioned was it's going to be a 1.5 year adjustment roster-wise, but then a 2 year adjustment on the back end. In other words, like the next person, they're not going to have a Mike Leach disciple take over after Mike Leach and Mississippi State inevitably fall out of love like he has everywhere else. That was what I heard the most of.
Separate from that, did anybody hear anybody pick Clemson to win that game? Because I didn't either. The people, and I know Dabo Swinney may get what he wants there. The thing that I heard was the people who said Clemson could win, it was like in a vein of like, heart of a champion type stuff.
Yeah.
Like they belief in Trevor.
Right, and belief in Trevor. But when people said LSU could win the game or LSU will win the game, it was because of stats, Joe, the receivers, the defense playing better, Dave being Dave, all, you know, on and on and on, the things about LSU. It was definitely more, God, what's the word I'm looking for? Intangible for Clemson than it was for LSU when you just talk about who was going to win the game.
That's interesting because we've seen Clemson in that in that setting, in the national title setting, way more than we've, I mean, more than we've seen this LSU combination. Now, the thing I got was a lot of people wanting to see...
Also Venables, I should say. Yeah. Everybody, like...
Belief in Venables, yeah.
The belief of, I mean, he is, this guy, Venables is a god at this thing, and he's not even here.
There's a weird amount of equity that certain guys command. It might even be I mean, Venables is well thought of, period, but I mean, you know, yeah, in coaching circles, some of these guys are just, you know... on a pedestal. No, I had a lot of people wanting to see how Ohio State would apply itself personnel-wise against LSU. Just in a hypothetical. Not that they deserve to be. None of that tweet shit. Yeah, yeah. None of that we saw on Monday night, but a lot of coaches being like, they found it more interesting in the hypothetical sense to match LSU and Ohio State's personnel against each other. But again, not in a like fuck Clemson kind of way. It was just like, hey, that might be cool to see X or Y. So I thought that was interesting. A lot of people have echoed what we've said on the show this year. It's maybe not a more talented Ohio State program right now, but because I'm sure Bud can tell me that they've actually been mathematically more talented before, but they look and execute in a better way than they ever have, especially in the back end of that Meyer run. I heard a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, look, but it's pretty clear, like, Urban's best years when he or his first four when he gets to a program.
Yeah.
It was true at Florida, true at Ohio State. He wasn't really – how long was he at Utah? Four only, probably?
I don't even know if he got to four at Utah. Maybe he did.
It was three. We'll look it up in a second.
So the Utah example is not really relevant there. But it does seem like Day has the – a real chance to maybe take them to another level.
So this is something that I think is interesting because in soccer, when you think about soccer jobs, like the way people talk about soccer jobs at the highest level of the Premier League with coaches and players, they talk about it as like a project. And you come into a project and you come into obviously win trophies, whether that's Champions League at the top level, a league title in one of the big five leagues in Europe, or like a domestic cup, FA Cup, or you know, Checker Trade Trophy, or whatever. They talk about it in a sense of like a project, and there's this understanding that you're not going to be there forever. You know, you get the job done, and then everybody moves on. And like Urban Meyer, I think has that. A little bit of that with his jobs. It's hey, I'm going to get you a championship. It's going to happen. Are you willing to put up with that? And, you know, put up with all of this. I'm gesturing to thin air.
Some guys are much better change agents than they are sustainers.
Right, right. And
it's a different skill set.
And Urban is arguably like the best change agent the game's ever seen.
Because of how he motivates players, yeah. Because of his own expertise with offensive scheme.
The immediate uptick you see in recruiting, like the excitement he's able to create. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, like, really, really good job. He's not really showing the ability to sustain anywhere.
Yeah.
Not sure if we have a ton of hockey crossover, but a lot of people who do follow the NHL are probably screaming that right now. Change agent is a much more prominent role in hockey. It's why you see a lot of firings midseason of head coaches for immediate like culture, chemistry, and pairing reasons. Obviously, it's a slower process in football. As we record, I am double-checking to see if we have any breaking news on Baylor. No, I would like to say this, though. The way that this one's shaken out is very funny. We've all seen, as we record, the photo of Justin Fuente and the staff and that sort of like awkward hostage scene. Like it's obviously their Monday – or what's today? Not Monday. It's Thursday. This is what I've been reduced to.
Dear King.
Yeah. Well, we'll get there in a second. Because it was weird for that to happen on the floor too. We'll get to Derek King in a second. To have Justin Fuente go from leading candidate, which a lot of people reported, and Justin Fuente emerging as top name again. Love the verbiage there on how these tweets come out. Right, it's all layered.
I think I know. I feel
right. It's amazing to see how these things are placed out in the public for particular reasons at particular times, and then to see Fuente. Boom, like that, as I snap my fingers in the microphone, sending out that staff photo.
Like a hostage photo.
Hi, I'm in Blacksburg.
There's like three people smiling, and one of them is Fuente.
Hi, I'm in Blacksburg. I'm in Hokies colors. We're having a staff meeting right now. 2020 Hokies. Well, here's what I can tell you about that. What that means is Fuente, it doesn't mean that Fuente did an interview. I don't even think he would say that, I would hope. Fuente definitely interviewed. It was that at some point in this process, Fuente went from thinking, if I leave Blacksburg, I go out and the press gets that I've interviewed, I better have a better than 50% chance of getting this damn job. I think and feel that Justin Fuente thought he had way better than 50% chance of getting this job. And when guarantees weren't locked in time, he had to essentially had a panic moment and decided, I got to pull out. because he didn't want to be caught holding the bag on both sides of the aisle, meaning losing out on Baylor and then also coming home to VTech and saying, hey, you were ready to jump to Baylor. So what he can do technically is say, I didn't consider it, or I'm pulling out of consideration, all that kind of crap.
I'm not saying this is what happened here.
Yeah.
But there will also be, when some of these things happens, like ADs will say, okay, you've come to me with your offer. All right, take it, motherfucker.
Yeah.
And now now you're rocking a hard place. And that sometimes will happen. I'm not saying this is what happened here at Virginia Tech, but that also can happen.
I know this. I know Whit Babcock pretty well. He had a list ready to go. I guarantee you he was more than ready. So the highest compliment I can pay an athletic director in these situations is always being ready for almost any scenario with your head coach. Because this is very late in the cycle to be dealing with this as Virginia Tech. This is something a G5 goes. This is something Louisiana Lafayette was prepared to go through. So, all right, Derek King, and then we'll close by flattering Bud. Derek King, Bud, well, you called this one too, Bud. On the show, I kept saying I spoke with Dana Holgorsen multiple times. Derek King essentially redshirts himself, right? They were doing this whole roster manipulation mode after four games, where basically a handful of the most talented players on Houston's roster redshirted out this season. So they sort of like tanked in a college football way.
The funny thing is, the person who actually told me about this was a track coach. And he was like, look, this is something that we will sort of do sometimes in the track coaching profession, I should say,
yeah.
Is where we'll kind of tanking is like kind of the word, but it's like we'll load up for next year.
Yeah.
If we know we've got a couple seniors who we can say, or upperclassmen who we can save eligibility or kind of skim some eligibility off of, we will take them, we'll redshirt them, and we'll load our lineups for the next year. And that was sort of a thought about what Houston was doing. Is Houston redshirting these guys to be really good next year?
So Kendall Briles was the offensive coordinator of Florida State this past year under Willie Taggart. Kendall Briles also coached Derek King at Houston. He put up fantastic numbers and really kind of the sole highlight of the Major Applewhite era in a lot of ways. Bud, you called this shot out of the air back in October saying that he would transfer, he would get in the portal. Dana, everyone else, King's family said, no, we're good. We're committed to Houston.
Me? I said this.
Monday night during the national title, Derek King enters the portal. I can tell you this. As a reporter, I talked to people at Houston. He did notify Dana. He did notify the assistants about an hour beforehand. He was at workouts and meetings that morning.
You know what else happened that morning?
Yes, bud.
The semester started. So now Houston cannot cut his aid until summer semester starts.
Right.
That's the rule. If you jump in the portal, they can cut your aid once the current semester finishes out. That's mm-hmm. why these kids wait to jump, very smartly here, until the semester starts.
But what about the ones that do jump in December? And they just...
I think some of these kids give bad advice.
Do you just think they panic?
Hold on, because you were having...
I think some of them are unaware that, like, if you jump once the semester starts, you get to finish out the current semester.
I was going to say, I'm glad you brought that up.
He hasn't graduated yet, right? Like, right. He graduates in the spring.
No, he is a grad transfer.
Correct. He will be a grad transfer.
Right.
He's saying he hasn't graduated yet.
He's not a grad transfer now.
No, Houston told me he has a degree.
Well, then why the hell isn't he in somebody's spring practice already?
I don't know.
And like, that's silly.
I think the family, I was assured that
maybe
he already has
his
degree.
Degree.
Yeah. I mean,
spring.
But we'll double check for when we come back next week. But that was the first. So you and I, because I found out with you, we were watching the game in a bar. Yeah. And then I spoke with some people at Houston after the fact. And I said, I asked them about the, you know, hey, does he get the aid for the semester? And I said, yeah, but he already has a degree. What I can tell you is this.
I wanted to go back to Bud. Because Bud, when he talks portal, like I was fly on the wall for some of Bud's conversation. So I'll give Bud this. Like me and Godfrey are here and we kind of talk more the coaches. But Bud, it's really interesting to be with Bud at this thing because Bud is talking to coaches, of course, but also like personnel guys. Guys who are not on the field coaches, but guys who have roster control or what have you. And it's funny to hear Bud talk to them because Bud like knows these players. He's mm-hmm. seen these players, scouted these players, and he's talking to them on a level about, you know, who can they get, who do they want, that kind of stuff. And so when you started talking to these guys about the portal and what the portal's done to the psychology of the game, for lack of a better term, I just thought it was really cool to kind of sit and be a fly on the wall to some of those discussions that you were having while we were here.
Yeah, it really was. And I had a lot of different story ideas, you know, sort of around the portal and around the process. And you know, what's changed. And I think 2 years ago, the last time we really had substantive talks about this, a lot of them were reactive, and now some schools are more proactive, right? Like, we talked to an SEC school at lunch, and they're like, yeah, we actually have two guys who are dedicated to the portal.
Yeah, just sitting there refreshing.
I was like, you have two dudes who all they do is hit F5 on the portal?
They like, and he was like, yeah, they like watch film on guys and look.
Yeah, and they also, they manage our walk-on program too. So it's not the only right. thing they do. And my head was like, okay, so basically you had two guys who were full-timers who probably weren't doing that much before. Now that's what they do. But you know, there's all different ways schools handle it. With King, I was like, there's no way that if he's actually a grad transfer, and with all due respect to Dana, that he's going to come back to Houston.
Right.
Like, dude, you're going to be one of the hotter commodities on the market. Dana didn't recruit you, right? Like it wasn't like you were with him for 4 years. You were with him for, like, half of a year.
Exactly.
I don't know. Like, I just never bought the idea that he was going to return to Houston. I thought he was trying to finish out his degree on their dime.
Yeah.
On the DL. And he played it beautifully, by the way.
I think
is
there's
the other kid transferring? The other kid who also did that, I'm going to sit out and we're going to be better.
I don't know yet. Well, there are multiple kids. I don't know yet. The only one that we've talked about is King. As far as I was, again, assured by Houston that this was not a trend. They do feel good about their roster. They feel like they've recruited well. Obviously, they're going to play the portal too.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't really worry too much about Houston at all. This is a massive setback for them. I mean, so here's what I was going to throw out. Yeah, I mean, if I had to name a school right now, two schools, it would be Oregon or Oklahoma.
With Oklahoma, it was interesting because last year the word in the recruiting community was that Oklahoma had told Spencer Rattler, their quarterback who they signed, that they were not going to take a transfer. And then that kind of got amended to, we're not going to take a 4-year transfer. Like
while you sit in redshirt.
We'll take a grad transfer.
Right.
Jalen Hurts, obviously. Right. How does that play with Rattler if they were to go and get a second straight grad transfer?
Probably they add him to, well. Do they ask him to redshirt? Or?
I don't think he played, did he? Like, I think he could be primed to have a big-time year because the Oklahoma second-year receivers are going to be nasty.
We sure did hear a lot about Oregon around that convention floor, didn't we?
Hey, boy. So these Pac-12 schools are like,
Oregon, baby.
One of these things.
Yeah. Like the other,
as far as their recruiting tactics.
Aggression. I think Oregon's aggression, you know, certainly they don't look on the field like Oregon used to under Chip Kelly, but the ruthlessness by which they are conducting business that you would expect from an Alabama, an LSU, or one of the Floridas, Oregon is back in that mentality, which should not really shock a lot of people because Mario, I think he either believed it or he talked himself into it that they could apply the SEC principles to Oregon in a really sort of wholesale way,
yeah.
And that's what we're seeing. Now,
there's an element, though, that we have to consider, which is, according to our Pac-12 people, they said, look, the difference is, when you do some certain things in the SEC, we take that to the league office in the SEC. And,
right.
And the league helps to mediate. In this conference, in the Pac-12, if you do that, it might go straight to the NCAA.
It's because there is – right. Yeah. And in the SEC, there is this mutually assured destruction. Because
everybody's mm-hmm. doing something.
Because yes. everybody's doing something. But in the Pac-12, if there's only 2, 3, 4 doing something
–
yeah. Exactly. And you may stand out more of like a sore thumb. But the other thing
that's going to be, by the way, that's going to be tough for Clemson in the coming years. If they have to change their tactics and things prove to be more aggressive, there's a weird benefit for as much as these SEC programs hate one another to the
it's
fact that they're sort of handcuffed to one another in a lot of ways, too. But
the other thing with the Pac-12 that was the funniest thing about the whole time is like, hey, all the things that you hear us say about the Pac-12, all the things that you, dear reader, think about the Pac-12,
right,
if you're not on the West Coast, these guys also think it and say it.
All right, let me set this up. So Richard and I were with a personnel director that will not be named at a Pac-12 institution. And let me back up and say this. Bud has a matter-of-factness to him, and it is a pure bullshit.
I call it economy of words.
Yes. Bud's going to cut through the bullshit, and he is not going to give you local anesthetic before he cuts you, okay? And all season long, Bud has been very matter-of-fact in talking about the economic disparity in Southern California and how that's affecting football prospects and their family, right? That's more of a thought-out kind of narrative. You've also just flat-out said, hey, look, the bodies aren't there. The talent's not there, the passion's not there, and the aggression in recruiting and development's not there.
The big bodies, that is, I asked a couple guys, I was like, look, what keeps you up at night? And it's the big bodies. There are not enough big bodies on the West Coast.
So we sat with the personnel director in the Pac-12, and I asked him basically all the same questions that we've asked Bud on the show about this. And not only did he say exactly what Bud Elliott has said on PAPN for the past year, he said it like Bud said it. And Richard and I kind of looked at each other, and I was like, I almost mouthed the words like, man, I'm like, does he know Bud? and... Yeah, so this guy works on the West Coast, and everything, and this is not, you know, this is not an invitation to pile on the Pac-12 doesn't give a shit. I think specifically it is an invitation for us to be really damn honest about where we draw the line in P5, the money, the way these staffs are developed. And yeah, if Oregon becomes an aggressive outlier, they're probably doing it to survive. USC, as we said earlier in the show, seems to not want to unfuck itself for a while. And the bottom line is this, the inventory in the West Coast is officially, I'll certify it now after the player personnel quoted Bud back to us, we've got issues. Also, and I don't know what they're going to do to fix it.
Right. The network is an issue.
Hashtag because Bud was right. Oh, that was the other thing.
It was brought up.
Yes.
It was brought up, the network, the exposure. That is something these guys think about.
Kids watching the games on their cell phones and not knowing where the hell, like having no brand recognition for some of the top end brands of the Pac-12. I'm not talking about Oregon State here, guys. The dude was telling us, like,
in high school in Houston, we got to explain ourselves. You know what I mean? Like, we got to, like.
Can you imagine being a Pac-12 school and walking into a major American city, and they don't even know, like, who you are?
Right.
He literally said, we have to explain where, without giving us away,
yeah, school
where
is.
Our state is.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was a state, yeah, yeah.
This is a very successful
program. So, spoiler, it wasn't Stanford.
Right.
Yeah.
And like, the other thing is the under-leveraging of when they do get in this situation. It was kind of like a hypothetical. It was like, what did Washington's Rose Bowl, Fiesta Bowl, playoff berth, 3-year stretch do for Washington?
Yeah.
Now, a little bit of that has to do with Chris Peterson and how Chris Peterson is, mm-hmm. just from a personal perspective. Godfrey, you can tell stories about how Washington does not necessarily play ball the way that you would expect them to in a media relation perspective. But the other thing is, you know, I wrote the story on LSU's social media department, and the person who was talking to me was like, LSU leveraged this playoff run with what they were able to do with their social media department in this incredibly novel and cool way. And they were like, man, I wish we had that for when. Now, obviously, they didn't pay off those visits with wins, but it was like, I wish we had that when we were on those stages to elevate our brand.
And just to look at the entire conference as a whole for a second, USC, we decided, is a smoking crater, total mess right now. Washington, we don't know what they're going to be under Jimmy Lake. Notoriously anti-media, right? Oregon now, I can tell you directly as a reporter, Oregon has gone from, I'm going to say an open doors policy, but they were very much more accessible than they are now. That's Mario's Alabama influence shining through, where they're kind of walling off and becoming a tower. So, go ahead.
I had a couple people think that Cristobal is going to coach at Auburn sometime soon.
Yeah, like, you know what?
Like, where is this coming from?
That's
Did
a,
you hear this?
No, I, that's a hell? Weird. I've seen
Sorry,
that.
I didn't interrupt you
no, before. I've seen that during silly season before,
no,
too.
That's fine. Where is that from? What connections does he have?
There is a long held, like, wish fulfillment narrative amongst Auburn fans that one of these Saban disciples
comes
to Auburn.
And Luke, I am your father's.
Like, coaches are, like, picking up on this fan fiction and repeating it to us?
No, I just think that people are trying to plug in a guy like Cristobal who has SEC bona fides and then look at jobs and their propensity to open in the next 2 to 3 years. Because I've heard this. It was Lane Kiffin to Auburn, okay? It was Kirby Smart to Auburn. Like, I've heard this before.
It's not a Cristobal thing. It's a
I doubt it, Auburn man. Thing. I mean, I'm not saying would Cristobal do well at Auburn. I think he'd do great. And if they did make a move from Gus, I bet he would be in a top five list. Yeah. But do I think there's smoke on it? No.
This is a good example of we didn't do a whole lot of show planning today. Like we
No, it's okay.
Our pre-show meeting was from the co-working space where we're doing meetings to the hotel.
On that note, we're about to have a post-show meeting because we're hungry. Bud has to go to an airport, and we're all different levels of hungover and tired. When we see you next week, we'll probably sound very different. We'll be back in our home studios. Gentlemen, thank you very much for a wonderful AFC.
Go Tigers.
Go Tiger.